support, you know, than being.
I've got a carer starting shortly.
Oh, you have. Oh,
yeah, well, it's just, once again, this is the sort of thing that you get shortened. I miss a lot of old people. I mean, I was in that care home, a shelter accommodation, for 18 months.
Mm.
I left there in middle of 2014, and I still go back every fortnight and see them. Every fortnight I go down there.
Mm. Do you go to stay the night or just stay
for the night? No, just go down to visit them, a couple of hours. And I walk in the door, they're all sitting in the, you know, lounge. Oh, hello, Arthur, and they always been smiles. Mm. And it does me a world of good.
Whereabouts was that? Did you say it was in Catford?
Yeah, Catford Hill. Right by Catford Hill. Yeah. Mm. It's called the Vineries. It's about 34 little flats, all self-contained. And I was in the independent, and you see, I got the, you can see the old... I've got the old link line.
Oh, yeah, sorry, that's like the panic. There's a little red button thing there that's a panic. I think you press that, don't you? It's a panic button.
Well, I don't even bother.
Well, I mean, I suppose because
I have loads of contacts, special room numbers, and if I ring up the ambulance station, I say, Mr. Gadotti here. All right. It would be about 20 minutes.
Hmm.
And then I thought, what's wrong with me? The night doctor, what do you call him now?
Not locums.
Not locum, no.
Out of our service?
From the
GP?
Cell doctor. I suddenly get my name there. Oh, hello, Arthur. How you doing, mate? Yeah, I think I need a bit of help. I'll be down about an hour.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. They come down to me, and they let me have a little chat about it. I think we go to hospital. I said, I don't think so. No, nothing, no, really. No, I want some steroids. That's the one I can never remember the name of. I have a box out there which I get bakshi, and I just keep it, and if I want to use it, I use them. Mm. They give me... antibiotics. Mm. Come to boxes. They're out there now. And if I want them, I take them.
Mm. Well, they trust you to know where.
I must do.
Mm.
I mean, normally,
you'll be sensible with...
I know a lot of people, if one tablet makes them feel good, two should make them feel better. And four might better still. And that'll kill you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't think that there's many people that they would trust with, you know, these sorts
of... Another thing is you shouldn't stop taking them either.
No. Well, exactly, with the penicillins, that's the other thing, isn't it, is to make sure people follow.
If I want to stop taking them, I wait till I see my doctor and have a chat with her. And then, she said, what do you think, Arthur? She asked me. I said, well, I think I'd like to go on about another couple of weeks, and I think I want to knock them down off it then.
Mm.
Not cut them out. Cut them down to one a day instead of four or whatever it is.
Can I just ask you, you know, you said that your nanny left you out in the garden. Mm. What happened to the nanny? Because
the problem was I had a nanny at St Mary's Road, Beckham, and she lived about three doors away from where we lived, and that was okay. When we came to Botany, she couldn't really manage the journey. I mean, she was getting old in years. I love my nanny; she was very nice. So when Mum got here, she had to go to an agency, and then you got no recommendation because it was their own district. If it'd been in Peckham, she probably would have gone to one of the other, but he thought we'd temper measure. So we got this young woman come down, and she left me out in the garden of my farm.
But what was the reason for her to do that?
Well, she wasn't running me crying, was she?
Because, yeah, that's a bit of a funny thing to do.
She'd just forgotten. She'd put you there for some fresh air and then just forgotten.
If I had thought about it, I could have asked her, but I was only 6 months old, you see, so that's a little difficult.
But what did your parents, what happened to the nanny? I don't know.
I imagine my father would have, he wasn't a vindictive man. I think he would have just said, you know, you learn from this, don't send her out again on such a young child. I don't know. I mean, I'm just, because I knew my father pretty well.
Mm.
And I spent a year in hospital.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you must be a hardy soul. Well, I mean, clearly you are.
And that's
why telling us.
I call my respite for trouble now. That and the 6 years, 7 years in the jungle.
Mm.
I mean, the war is such a... It's people understand. They think, well, it's all shoot, bang, fire. But you go, we want to see it, one see a chap, I thought, anywhere. And then we came to a village one day and we asked for water and they gave it to us. We came back there. We advanced 20 miles, then we retreated 10 miles, then we advanced again, we went back again, then we went west, then we went north. We never knew where we were half the time. And the officer didn't know either.
And this was in Burma, was it?
In Burma, yeah.
At the end of the Second World War,
yeah,
just after?
Was it just after? I'd been out there 20 or 30 years before we got there.
So just tell us how you got involved with the war. Did you sign up?
Or could I say yes? Yeah. Could you tell us a little bit about your... Because obviously, as you became an adult and joined up, were enlisted, or have you...
Well, when I was about 13 or 14, I put my age up a year, so I'd do fire watching. And I went out of the city, west end of London, up on a 10-storey building on the roof with a bucket, spade, a bucket of water, and a bucket of sand. They're then sending bombs come down, you put them out. But they started putting bombs inside them.
Inside the incendiary?
Yeah, and I chucked that in. I said, no, wait a minute, you can't put a bomb out with a bloody bucket of water. So I volunteered for war work. Now, you had to be 15 to do war work. And in Goldhawk Road, Shepherd's Bush, I was in the basement of a 6 or 7 storey building, old Victorian building. And in the basement, there were pillars as wide as that case over there at Tallboy, all round to support the roof. So if you got bombed, you just wait for it to go out. No problem.
And this was doing war, did you say doing what's called doing war work?
War work, yes.
Which was what, just helping out as required with
and
digging
out? And we were filing aluminium, the aluminium boxes. We were filing all the rough edges around the hole and that sort of thing. And we were told, let me ask you what you're doing. You're sorting out nuts and bolts. We had to sign the official secret act. And one day they bombed it and they buried us. So we got the cards out. And we played cards for about 12 hours.
So this was when the bomb landed on the building above, wasn't
it? Yeah. But see, we knew it was safe enough. We knew it didn't do a dig out. This happened the second time, about a fortnight later. So then I packed in war work. So I put my age up then and said I was 17. Yes, you had to be 17 to be a soldier. So I went up to Coventry, unbeknown to my parents, and where's your birth certificate? Under 50,000 tonnes of rubble in London. Signed here, King Shilling.
This was in Coventry?
Yeah.
And unbeknownst to your parents?
Oh, yeah. The only problem cropped up when nationality cropped up. Because I had a dual nationality.
I.e. British and Swiss.
And I used to be trilingual as a small boy. Italian, French and British, English.
Wow.
And I spoke quite fluently, but as you lose them, then the walk along, speaking Italian or German wasn't a good idea. I can still speak quite a fair bit of German. And they'll say, I love you. Where are you going? Where do you live? I can make me not fluent because I'm using much. There's a cafe down the road here, Bottomless Road, called The Gantry. It's a French cafe. I went in one evening, hadn't been all that long, about 3 years ago. And I heard the manageress talking in French. And I said, but on the road, madame. She said, je veux pas français. Oui. Je français, un peu. Not a lot. And then we had the World Cup. And France were playing in the World Cup because a lot of people there were French because it's the one place where French people accumulate. And I'm there and I stood outside singing the Marseillaise. After one line, they're all la-la-line. And I'm singing away there, along the pont de la patrie, le jour de roi arrivé, right through.
So you were the only one that knew all the lyrics?
Yeah, and they're all French. And she came over to me and said, Arthur, you're the first man I've ever met, French or English, who actually knows all the words of our own Plymouth national anthem. I used to know the German national anthem too, one time. Deutschland über alle.
But then, you best forget that one.
It wasn't a good thing to know, so you let it drop, you know.
Did she give you a glass? I hope she gave you a nice glass of French wine.
I got a world spot down there. And then, unfortunately, she got jealous. People used to come in there of an evening. Is Arthur in tonight? No, not in tonight. Been tomorrow, yeah. And about 6 or 8 of them walk out. Now, 6 or 8 people walking out is £200. It's quite expensive. but you've got a real venture. Mm. And you just experiment or with dishing up with them on me.
So who taught you these national anthems then in the different languages?
Lady friends. Most of the names I know are I had a Greek lady friend going out to India, going to the Mediterranean. And you see, I'm very soon, he's even a young lad. When I first joined ship, I said to one of the crew, what's the best job to get? Ship's peace.
And this was after the war? Or
no, going out to India.
Oh, big one, yeah.
No, I was going out to India. And I was only 16. I never worn boots, I never fired a gun, and nobody went home.
And this was after you'd done this, signed up.
And a year later, I got 30 men. I'm in charge. I got 3 stripes, and I got 30 men to keep alive.
What did you say to your parents about where you were going before going on the ship to India?
Oh, well, no, it was too late then. I mean, I had to tell my dad what I'd done, but so I didn't realise I had to give up my nationality. But it's too late then.
Oh, so they made you give up the non-British nationality.
Because, you see, if I'd been captured by the Germans or the Japanese, they could have shot you as a neutral alien working for, fighting for the enemy.
Right.
A bit dodgy, you know, don't really want that. With a name like Cadotti, I'll tell them Luigi Cadotti, you know, not exactly an old English name, is it?
No. So can you remember anything about your basic training, sort of after you signed up, but before
yes,
they put you... on the boat.
No, I've never been away from home ever myself. I've never worn boots. Never fired a gun. And then I'd only been in the army about a week. Mm. We did a forced march. 25 miles. Yeah, you run for 2 miles. You walk, you march. You run, you march. But to get you to a long way away in a very short space, you amaze how much time you cover. When we got to Bulgaria, that was 20 miles from Glasgow, we had to throw a half dozen grenades, had a cup of tea, a sandwich, and we come back. Following behind us was a lorry. If you fell out, he'd pick you up. But you're letting the team down. Mm-hmm. So I come back, my feet all bleeding. I've never had a very good fever since then.
But if you'd never done these things before, what was the inspiration for you to sign up and do all of that?
Well, although I suspect, I've always been very much a loyalist. I believe in my country. I believe in the British Empire. I remember the day when I was quite young at school, 8, 9, 10. I always kept an eye. I had an adult mind. And you'd hear that there's some trouble out somewhere in the Middle East or something, and we threatened to send out 25 battleships. And they said, oh, sorry, no, we're not going to, we won't bother. We kept peace for it. And do you know why a war happens roughly every 25 years? And usually a major world war is usually roughly every 25 years, usually. Well, it's been for centuries.
Because it's a generation?
That's it. It's a new generation who thinks war is glorious, charge with a sword and a battle. I was a brigadier's bodyguard, and he was a brigadier is one step below a general. And then you ever see an officer with red tabs, red lapels? He's a full paid officer. If I'm in battle and I'm a captain, and all the other officers are killed, I can be a general and wear his uniform, but I only get paid as a captain.
Well, they're not silly, are they?
Not really. No.
So that was your motivation then. You kind of, I suppose you. But as I think, did like a lot of people felt that it was the.
Well, I mean, I'm being brought up in a lap of luxury, servants, beautiful house, travel around Europe, being able to speak 3 or 4 languages, you know, without any trouble. I never trouble learning. When I went to play bowls, I only played about 3 or 4 games, and I was picking up and beating some of the less able people. Like I said, at school, I was all in the top 3. Very, very rarely, whatever, those 3 boys, not. I'm on always top. Some years I didn't bother very much. But as I said, I'm sitting in class, not paying attention, and the teacher turned around and said, and I know word for word what he said. And I have a vast knowledge of almost any subject in the world. I actually won over £100 at oh, where was it now? Where's the mecca of bowling?
Crown Green Bowling.
Grass bowling.
The grass one. I'm afraid I don't know.
Thinking tennis lords.
Oh dear. Anyway, I went there just to make out the numbers. I mean, I wasn't like on that standard then. And I stood at the end of the green, and there was 120 people playing in white, all at the same time.
On
separate greens. Normally the green has six, the bowling green usually has six playing areas.
Okay.
Very little inside, but all fairly standard. And they've got about seven or eight greens. I can't think where it is now. Isn't that amazing? That's the mecca of our bowling. Anyway, I went into the canteen or a restaurant, seated about 400 people. And the managing director there, fatly posh, very well, fatly posh, come over. He said, "I heard that you're boasting you can talk on any subject." I said, "Well, not any subject, but quite a few." He said, "Right, we'll take you up on that." He said, "I'll put £20 there." And let's see, I know there's a pile of money on the counter, about £100. I thought, "Well, your money, mate. I've got nothing to lose." So I go into a hall, about 300 or 400 people in there, like up on the stage. "Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. I've now been, what's the word I used? Shanghaied into fulfilling a rather foolish boast I made. I have boasted that I can talk to you for half an hour on almost any subject in the world, but you must be reasonable in so much as some, I will know what they mean and let alone anything about them." So I said, "Any suggestions? Pyramids." I said, "Oh, lovely, very nice. How old are the pyramids?" Someone said, 3,000 years. I said, "Very good, actually 3,217. No one queries it. If any other person give out the times.
So you didn't actually know that there were 3,217?
No.
Just trying to sounding authority.
Oh, my goodness.
And then,
so that's the trick?
That's the trick. And they tell me.
And you just elaborate.
I've got a fair knowledge. I know. Did you know if you get a map of the heavens, a map of the Orion, there are five stars, you know, a little group. If you went on an airplane, look down on the pyramids, that is Orion. One large one, one medium one, two slightly smaller, and one smaller. And Orion is where all the pharaohs went when they died. All their valuables, and even their slaves and that, were all packed in the tomb to take with them. And the ability, they found proof, they did heart operations.
Oh, the ancient Egyptians?
Yes, yeah.
They were an amazing civilization.
And the ability to preserve a body. I mean, you uncover a mummy today, and consider it 3,000 or 4,000 years old, it's in a remarkable state of preservation.
So this was this, and thus you won your £200.
Yes, and the first pyramid was built 100 years before the Great Pyramid. Now, in those days, 100 years was today or tomorrow. The day 100 years is the future. So, I mean, things didn't move that much. So I started thinking that the pyramids were built from had to stop building, it was going to fall down. And 100 years later, we built the biggest building ever built by man, weighing several million tons. And if you stand at the bottom of the pyramid, as low as you can go, there's a hole 600 feet up, it comes out near the point. Once a year, when Orion goes through the sky, you can see it. Only once a year. Like Stonehenge.
Yes, well, these are like the sort of
summer and winter solstice. The sun will shine or moon will shine on the altar. Now, how do they know this? I read only recently that the Egyptians knew circumference of the world to within a few hundred metres.
Great mathematicians.
We still thought the earth was flat. The Sphinx is 15,000 years older than the pyramids. And the wear and tear on the Sphinx is not, as you might think, sand, it's water. Mm. So the North African Egypt was a very fertile area, right through the whole Sahara Desert. Mm. If you dig down now, you'll find trees and coal and all sorts there. Mm. And I think I told you, it moves south half a mile practically every year, and you can't stop it. Mm. If you build a wall, it goes over it, knocks it down, or it goes round it. So in a few, I don't know how many years, a few thousand perhaps, the whole of Africa would be desert. Mm. That's been the whole of the world.
It would be a pity.
Oh, that's the whole of the world. I don't know, I have no idea how many years, but it's not such a fantastic time, I tell you. Mm. All the deserts, all the tundra, all the pampas and the various wild areas, like in North, the Arctic and Antarctic, well, you're going to take over the world.
Well, yes, I mean, I think that's a big worry, isn't it? The changes afoot.
Yeah, I mean, how many animals in my life have disappeared?
Mm. Well, exactly.
Quite a few, believe me.
So it sounds as though with this, it was with all this sort of, like, being the bright young lad that you were, and with your kind of curiosity about the world, you, just to kind of bring us full circle, that you, that was, you know, you felt sort of like doing your bit about going and signing up, and then they took advantage of all your abilities and skills.
They sort of bumped
you up. So did you, does that, I mean, you have to forgive my ignorance here, I don't understand the ins and outs of commissioning and so on, but did they give you a commission? Did they get you in as an officer?
Oh, well, they tried it. But you see, they go about it the wrong way. I'm up in Glasgow. I've been in the army about 4 or 5 weeks. You only have 6 months up there. And I was factory posh. I had my voice was very refined. We were taught at school, elocution. In those days, they believed that's important. If you're going to be anybody in anything, you don't want to go to Buckingham Palace and ask your father, mate, when you... You have to know your pros and cues.
And did you have these elocution lessons here in Broccoli?
Oh, yes, yes. And at Colts.
And did your elocution teacher come from the area, do you think?
Yes, I think it basically would be. Mostly local people, local ladies mostly. We only had about 4 or 5 teachers, but about a dozen pupils at the private school. House is still there, but no longer a school.
So your voice set you aside and a little bit different to some of the recruits.
So I went, you wanted a HQ. If I, mark time, halt! And you saluted, can I go to 251. That's your number, your army number. 1-4-5-4-2-5-1. 1442, 52, 51. It's the same, as you did the MBs, you're getting really upset, you said. What's your number? 1-4-5-4-2-5-1. 1442, 52, 51. You've got two numbers now, it's the same number.
Well, did that confuse them?
The military police
perhaps not being the sharpest tools in the box.
They weren't the bane of bitten, I tell you. Oh, boy.
Very good. So there you were then. So you were marched up to the, what was he? It'd be a colonel.
Colonel and the captain of majors. And there's something like, Gunny Gaddotti, sir, do you want to be an officer? No, right, thank you. Right, next one. If there's a problem, we should have sat down somewhere and said, we believe by your bearing and your, obviously, your way of life, your speech, your knowledge of other languages, such like, you would be good material as an officer. I think I would have been. Mm. But I just joined the army. I just made 2 or 3 friends. Down in Glasgow. People who live in Glasgow come down to London for their basic training. Mm.
I wonder why they did that.
Start popping home every night.
Oh, so people wouldn't go home. Bunking off kind of thing.
In the war, a bit dodgy. You couldn't travel around Britain. And all the stations, all the signs were moved. All the trains were checked by MPs almost every day. We did things you can't do. I was stationed in Thetford, up in near Norwich. And I went from Thetford to Exeter without changing trains. No, you can't do that.
What, anymore?
No. Because there was London, North Eastern, Great Western, Midland, London, Midland, Scottish. Four main railways. Or Southern Railway. And you couldn't do that. You'd be trespassing on other people's territory. And we got on the train at Thetford and then up at Exeter. Topson Barrett's.
So, what, just because they were running differently during the war?
Oh, yes. I mean, they probably pulled out a few bales here, a few bales there, and just joined them up.
Mm.
I mean, but they were separate companies.
Mm.
Different colours, different uniforms.
Right. So, but just to go back to this thing, then, so you turned down the chance to become an officer, and you then stuck it. What was your rank at that stage? You were gunner?
No, I was just private then.
Private.
Yeah, and then I was sent to, I think now, Salisbury Plain. Ah. Can't think of the name of it. The camp there. Fourth field, 25 pounders. That's hard there. Then I became gunner. Now, a gunner is one rank higher than other regiments.
Okay.
So a corporal in the artillery is the equivalent of a sergeant in the infantry.
Okay.
So if you ever go to a big meeting of military personnel, it starts off, "Good evening, lords, my lords, lords, and something, and ladies and gents, gentlemen of the Royal Artillery, and all other officers of ranks, etc., blah, blah, blah."
So they get a special separate mention?
Oh, yeah. We're the oldest regiment in Britain.
Okay. And so was that... Did you, as a young recruit in that time, did you have any choice over which regiments?
Yeah,
so you in a sense, chose...
If you volunteer... Now, how do you know... So I think you've got a friend of yours, a man of my age group, and he says you volunteer. What was your number? It should start 144. If it doesn't start 144, he was not a volunteer. In return, every 12 months you would change your regiment, in wartime.
Sorry, so 144 meant you volunteered?
You were a volunteer, yeah.
And you got slightly special, different treatment.
In the 12 months, if you wanted to change your regiment, I joined the artillery because they were safe walking. I'd done more bloody walking in the artillery than I did. I would have done as an infantryman.
But presumably you couldn't, if you were in your... battalion or what have you, regiment, and you were like at the front or seeing action, and then your time came. You couldn't literally just say, "Well, I'd like to transfer." But still, it's kind of a lot of more freedom than the enlisted men got, isn't it? And so, presume and the did we? And I mean, again, show my ignorance here. Mm. We did reach a stage, didn't we, in the Second World War where men were called up?
Oh yes. But there were a lot of volunteers, I tell you.
Hmm.
There were a lot, yeah. We were quite patriotic. Majority of people in this country loved their country and didn't always agree with everything, but we had a pretty good life. I mean, I think the Empire was a wonderful thing. The Empire stopped many world wars. All we had to say was, well, if you don't behave yourself, we'll send 25 battleships, 15 cruisers and 100,000 men. Oh, don't do that. We were only kidding.
Mm.
And that with China and the Boxer Wars and all and nothing like that. And just had to threaten. I went to Scarpa Flow with my family before the war, and we went out to see the fleets, just the Atlantic Fleet. And we sat in a paddle steamer, and we sailed for 8 hours or and then we got to the end of it.
Sailing past all the battleships?
Oh, there must have been 200 or 300 battleships.
And this is at Scarpa Flow in Scotland, isn't
when the King and Queen went out there to review the fleet. There's so many ships there. I mean, it was unbelievable. And we had Atlantic Fleet, Pacific Fleet, South Atlantic Fleet, Indian Fleet. I mean, we had ports all over the world.
Mm.
To cover the five oceans.
Places like Aden, Malta, also Hong Kong.
Well, the sun never set on the Empire,
Never did. I'm very proud of that. I think people say, they dominated the world, but they didn't. If you go to India, you'll see some of the cleverest railways in the world. Mm. There have been lots of television, but they handle more people in one day at Bombay Station, but back to all the stations in Europe. Tens of millions.
Mm.
And
the trains
are tied up a string, and they break down and get a hammer, and a bit of rope, a bit of wire.
Yeah,
and they go to the mountains, they go over the mountains, under the mountains. Oh, it's fantastic.
Hmm.
Can I just ask, it might seem like a bit of a shift, but so what made you come back to Broccoli after the war?
My home. I came back to Tunbridge Wells first. I first came up here. My mother was still evacuated down there for about a few months. Then I came up down there because our house, the top two floors next door, were burnt out. I came home on embarkation leave, go to India. I walked in the front garden, the top two floors all burnt out and all tarpaulin.
Of your family
yeah,
home?
Yeah, and where's my dad? I had no idea where that was. Was he all right, you know?
So you'd not heard, you just didn't know then?
No, he didn't get that sort of contact in the war because he'd always on the move somewhere. And, and when I went to India, I went to a place called Kalyan, just outside Bombay. It's the biggest collection of armed men ever in the world. And there's about 3.5 million men all in one place. There's five great camps. My address was number one regiment, number two battalion, so right throughout number five camp, Kalyan.
So it was very difficult for mail to make it there. It wasn't very practical.
Not really.
Yeah. So this was, I was just wondering, so maybe just if I could just call a quick sort of interval.
Yes, yeah.
I'm just thinking, I've got half an hour of the time. It's now 9:30.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering whether, I mean, clearly we're not going to be able to record all of your story here today. And I'm just
wary. I hope you don't mind if we come back.
Oh, yeah.
Is that okay?
I just think
thank you.
Rather than, I know that I sense that you could probably keep going. And I mean, I marvel at your stamina, but I don't think it would be very fair. We'll probably wear your vocal cords out.
Or
you'll be hoarse tomorrow. But I mean, I just thought that might be quite a good point to pause because then when we resume.
I found it quite interesting.
Oh, good. Because we found it interesting.
I was, what's the word I want? I was not ruminating.
Reminiscing,
yeah.
Reminiscing.
That's the only problem we've got nowadays. Every now and again, I come across a word. And I know the word.
It's you, Arthur. It's me as well. That's not just you.
But I basically don't give up. I find if you close your eyes and just try to put your mind blank, you'll suddenly say to yourself, antibiotics.
That's true, doesn't always work,
but it's, I've got things fairly well sewn up, you know.
No, I mean, I'm, you know.
I'm going to the hospital. I mean, you are going,
did you say?
I get treated, when I go there, I get treated like royalty.
That's brilliant.
It's ridiculous, really.
Nurses
have been working, have done a 15-hour shift. And we're going home now, and they come upstairs, up to a fifth or sixth floor, to say goodnight to me.
But you know what it is? I think it's just your, you know, you're very upbeat. Do you know what I mean? You've got a very positive outlook, and nothing beats that.
Do you know what I mean?
It's very inspiring, to lots of people,
inspiring.
You know, perhaps for their own, under their own steam.
I got my guest man coming back tomorrow afternoon. But tomorrow morning I'm up for an eye test.
Okay.
I can read the second line without glasses.
Oh my goodness, really?
Yeah.
See, the sad thing is, we'd like to see if we can come back because we're trying to work on this together. But I was saying to Richard when you were speaking to, is it Clarence? That I've got a commitment to. So we both work, but then after work, I've got to finish editing a film, and I've promised that I'd hand that in on the 31st of March. So it's Easter, basically in April, maybe April the 4th, something like that. Maybe we can come back, we'll arrange to come back, like...
I ain't got my phone number, do we need?
Exactly, but just to explain that perhaps... If it wasn't for Lorna's commitment to this thing, we'd say we can come back later in the week or early next week.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I think she just needs to get that out of the way.
Yeah.
So it might be,
it'll be a
10
of,
days
yeah.
to 2 weeks.
If that's okay, thank you.
As long as you're happy with that, then yes, what I'll do is I'll give you a call a bit near the time and maybe pop by and say hello as well again, or we'll just have a quick chat on the phone. And then we could hopefully fix a time then.
My magic calendar.
Oh, actually, if you've got your calendar, we can.
And I'm just going to pause this now. Then.
Yeah, that's good.